You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Hello and welcome on behalf of the Brookings Center for 21st Century Security Intelligence. My name's Ian Wallace. I'm the visiting fellow for cybersecurity here at the center. And today we are honored to have a distinguished panel to discuss the new cybersecurity framework. Essentially, this document represents the best efforts of the administration and, I think as we'll hear, industry representatives from the 16 critical infrastructure sectors to work together to address a threat which President Obama has called one of the gravest national security dangers the United States faces. I actually look forward to hearing more about how the framework was developed, because I think that's going to be pretty central to its future. But it's worth taking a moment to reminding ourselves that the voluntary framework owes its existence in large part to the failure of Congress to achieve consensus on cybersecurity legislation in the years up to 2012. And that, in turn, led to the President issuing Executive Order 13636 on improving critical infrastructure at the same time as his State of the Union address on the 12th of February 2013. And that, as the President has described it, set out to do three things: improve information sharing within the private sector, raise the level of cybersecurity across our critical infrastructure, and enhance privacy and civil liberties. And while the executive order contained a whole lot more than just the voluntary framework, it is clear that the framework has evolved as the centerpiece for the executive order and, by extension, the administration's cybersecurity policy, particularly as the vehicle for delivering the second and third of those aims, the raising the security while protecting privacy. And according to the executive order, the framework set out to provide a prioritized, flexible, repeatable, performance-based, cost-effective approach to managing cybersecurity risk. And by the way, it had to be completed within a year. So, now, I think it can certainly be argued to achieve one important objective, even if not the formal one, and that is to remove some of the political rancor from the debate, and that is in itself no mean feat. But the real question we're here to discuss today is whether the framework is going to make us any safer. And wrapped in that are some pretty fundamental questions. What is the framework? How is it meant to work? Will it be adopted? Even if it does, will it be sufficient to deal with the graveness of the threat that the President described? To get to grips with this, we are very pleased to be joined by the very man who was charged just over a year ago with delivering that framework, Dr. Patrick Gallagher, 14th Director of the Department of Commerce, National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST. And alongside him, Cameron Carey, now the Anne and Andrew Tisch Distinguished Fellow in the Governance Program here at Brookings, but previously the General Counsel and Acting Secretary at the Department of Commerce, and Dr. Dean Garfield, the President and CEO of the Information Technologies Industries Council. I'm not going to take too long over bios. I think you have got those, but just to recap, Pat became the NIST Director in November 2009, also serves as the Undersecretary for Commerce for Standards and Technology, joined NIST in 1993 as a research physicist, having obtained his PhD from the University of Pittsburgh, to where he is due to return later this year, having just been elected as their new Chancellor. Cam joined us at Brookings in December, affiliated with the Center for Technology and Innovation. He's also a visiting scholar at the MIT Media Lab. He became the General Counsel at Commerce in May 2009, working across Commerce's bewildering range of legal issues. And before that, he was a lawyer specializing in, amongst other things, telecommunications law. And Dean became the President and CEO of ITI in 2008, a position representing the tech sector in Washington and around the world, in fact. And previous to that, he held positions at the Motion Picture Association of America and the Recording Industries Association of America. Fantastic CV. Fun jobs to be doing, I'm sure. If I could begin handing over to my... I will begin by handing over to three panelists just to give some short remarks. Then I will lead a bit of a discussion, and then pretty quickly we'll open it up to the floor and give you the opportunity to ask some questions. I would ask you to keep your phones switched to silent. Feel free, however, to tweet or email them. The hashtag we're recommending is hashtag NISTCSF. So, Pat, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on the framework. Even among those people who've been critical in the past, have been, I think, universally complimentary about how the process is run, and that's a testament to the way in which NIST have gone about it. So well done on that. Just to kick off, perhaps you could start by telling us what the framework is, how it's meant to be used, and then touch on the process for how we, or how you and industry develop the framework, and then explain to us why this is going to do what the president wants and make us all safer.
Okay. So in just a few minutes, right? First of all, it's great to be here. Let me start with the what is the framework question, but answer it in a non-typical way, because you're probably expecting me to lay out how it's structured, what the key parts of the framework are, and a lot of you have probably taken a look at the framework. But let me actually do it from a different perspective, which is the some of the key attributes. First of all, the framework is a living document. One thing to really keep in mind is that it is not static. So when we ask the question, is this framework going to solve the problem, you're really going to get to a very different answer, which is, does this ongoing framework process continue to adapt and work for this? This is a very fast, dynamic area, and it's important that you understand this is an ongoing process. The other part about the framework that was critically important is this is a market response. What do I mean by that? You characterize sort of this as being a failure of Congress. I actually don't view it that way. But a discussion in Congress was rather naturally focused on questions of authority, and therefore so it had a lens already on the problem in terms of what the solution set was. What we're saying here is that one of the best ways to address cyber risk is to have the private sector organizations and companies and technology providers and all the others come up with a set of best practices that are maximally aligned with the way those organizations run. And for that to happen, it had to be basically a document that was a product of industry. And so what NIST did was actually adopt an approach that we use very often in standard setting to act as the convener and to act as sort of a facilitator, if you will, of a very broad multi-stakeholder, getting the band together to sort of have that critical discussion. But, because it had to be aligned with business, it means that the framework in the end was both what you would expect and I think something new. And the what you would expect is the set of controls and technology solutions and standards that were drawn from best practices across all the sectors. We call that the core. And that's in the framework in a very indirect way because it points to a whole set of standards and reference standards. And that's where a lot of the meaty details are. And the other part of the framework was really a structure to put all of those things into practice, and in particular to integrate those practices into the way the organization runs. And so it's specifically designed to not only talk to the technologists within organizations, but to talk to the leadership. And so it's designed to align with risk management. It's designed to provide tools like profiles where you can basically self-assess against all the various functional areas that constitute risk management for cybersecurity. And it was also designed to look at your maturity as an organization, because one thing that's very important is that, like many other risk mitigation behaviors in an organization, you get better, and that was important to acknowledge that, you know, and some have drawn the analogy with safety management. You know, you would start by addressing things by implementing certain rules and doing things in a particular way. But in fact, what you're after in a higher maturity is an ability to recognize risk and be adaptive and to be more proactive. And so the framework embraces some of that as well. So that, for me, is what the framework is. It's both the practices and the structure with which to support implementation. And I think the reason this is promising has to do with those attributes, the fact that it's owned by the stakeholders who have the most to gain by managing cyber risk, that it can be aligned with business practices and integrated with the other types of risk management that organizations do, and the fact that it is itself dynamic and adaptive to you know, the changing way we will use this technology and the way the technology itself is unfolding. In terms of the process, by the way, it's not over. We met the deadline of 1 year that was given in the executive order, but we've stated from the beginning that for this framework to make sense, what we're really talking about is kicking off a continuous process. And so the finish line here is not being done, it's being normal, where this is just part of the breathing and operating that we do routinely. And so what we're looking for is a normalcy of operation, not an end point. And the process has been one that was based around industry ownership and participation. We used every trick in the toolbook we knew how to do by putting things out publicly. No one, I think, was surprised by the final shape of the framework. It was multiple workshops across the country that built on each other, extensive public comment, every draft being up for comment, and we would anticipate that as we move into the next phase of the framework, ongoing framework process, we would maintain that approach.
Thank you. Plenty to dig into there, but before we do, we'll move on to Cam. Cam, you were there at the creation, you were at the beginning, you now have had the opportunity to step away and look at the process from the outside, which is almost a unique position to be in. Perhaps you could touch on sort of three things. Firstly, if you could just give us a sense of how things have changed as a result of this process and where we came from. I think it's important to remember exactly how things felt just over a year ago before the president spoke at the State of the Union and issued the executive order. And particularly as the former general counsel at Commerce, give a little bit of an insight into the privacy discussions that sat alongside the development of the framework. There was a draft privacy annex which drew some comment during the process, and that has changed in the final version. But if you talk to that. And third, and I think it might be interesting to get a sense of what you think the administration has learned from this process.
Well, thanks, Ian. And Pat, congratulations both on the framework and on the University of Pittsburgh announcement. Both terrific things, although NIST, Commerce, and the country, I think, will miss your hand on public policy issues. So we are, I think, in the outcome of this framework in a very different place than I think any of us would have predicted when this policy discussion started 3.5, 4 years or more ago. At that time, the sort of conventional wisdom was that the way to approach this issue was through some form of government prescription, using authorities of the Department of Commerce or of DHS or somebody to address cybersecurity by conventional rulemaking, and it'll go out and adopt a set of rules that would create a standard that people had to meet. This is a very different framework. What Pat has outlined today, what the NIST framework does, the model that it implements is something very different. And some of that certainly is a product of, you know, the Congress's inability to legislate on this. But, you know, part of that failure was sort of a lack of consensus about the right model, the right approach here. And I think more than anything, the model that's reflected in the framework reflects an evolution in the thinking about policy in this area, and appreciation for the complexity of the issue, the speed with which the technology is changing, both on the company side in terms of, you know, what it is that you're protecting, and what the risks are out there. This is constantly evolving at a pace that's simply much faster than conventional rulemaking can deal with. This has been a long process, but getting this done in a year is a lot faster than the pace of classic notice and comment rulemaking. This also is a model that is far more adapted to the technology space, to the world of digital communications and technology that really is at the heart of cybersecurity. And I think that's an important piece to stress here, that this model, which Pat described as a living document, is version 1.0. This is an iterative process of policymaking, something that, as Pat says, has been taken and moved over from standards setting, which is really why NIST was charged with the responsibility here, because that really is in NIST's sweet spot. It has done the guidance for federal agencies in the 800.53 documents that inform the framework. Part of the evolution of the model reflects an appreciation for NIST's success in developing standards, its engagement with industry, its role as an honest broker in the process. What we have is something that will help to move the needle in some important respects. Cybersecurity has emerged as one of the critical boardroom issues that companies of all kinds need to address in today's digital economy. This framework provides a set of benchmarks that corporate managers, boards of directors, and others can apply to ensuring that companies are meeting cybersecurity goals in ways that are going to protect their assets, that are going to be cost effective, and that you're going to meet the expectations of shareholders, of customers, other stakeholders in that environment. Other piece that I want to underscore in the framework is that it has been designed as something that can cross borders. The United States has taken a lead in establishing establishing a framework, establishing some standards, and doing so with a model that you know can be used around the world in this space. You know, it's been difficult in the current international environment in the wake of the Snowden disclosures to do that. But you know, it is important that the United States continue to lead here, that it continue to advocate for a model of regulation and governance in the digital space that that is adaptive, that is does not operate by government prescription, that you know can transcend borders. So this framework does that, and that's an important thing.
Thank you, and I think that is an extremely good lead-in to Dean. Dean, you represent a private sector perspective, and you know not only the tech sector, but presumably those people who your members support. I would be grateful if you could give us a sense of what you're hearing from the private sector about the framework. Are we going to get consent and evade, or is this something that's going to get into the bloodstream? And if you could also pick up Cam's point about the international dimension, you represent a global industry. Does this framework have the weight to build up an international following, or is it going to bump up against European notions of a more regulatory approach? And thirdly, as part of your role, you will talk to people on the Hill, and it'd be great to hear what you're hearing from legislators about how they're feeling about the framework.
You know, I'll try to address all three. I on the first question, I actually think it's the latter, that it will get into the bloodstream for two reasons. One, in part due to the process, and two, due to the substance. On the process, the way Pat described it, it made it seem quite inevitable and quite logical and linear, which in part it was, but it was that way because of the process that Pat had and put together, and the folks at NIST did as well, which was quite open, transparent, and collaborative. And I think he and the team at NIST is to be complimented for that. On the substance, I think there are three reasons why it will become a part of the bloodstream, and it will also speak to the question about the global impact. One is that the framework is actually quite flexible and based on risk management, and so it's not prescriptive. And I think because of that and because of the collaborative nature of the process, folks will feel as if they had an input into it and feel as if no matter what your business is like, there is something in there that enables you to integrate it. Second, the foundation for a lot of what exists in the framework are global standards that were developed through consensus-based multi-stakeholder processes, as Pat pointed out. And because of that, because they're global, because they're multi-stakeholder and open processes, I think the likelihood of success, particularly globally, is high. This is certainly, I think, a model for how these processes should be run internationally, both in the process and in the substance that result. And then finally, as far as a preliminary comment, the fact that it's iterative, but not iterative without a pathway forward, I think the inclusion of a roadmap that speaks to nine different paths or work streams, including international, is critically important. We all benefit from a open, integrated, interoperable internet, and Cam alluded to it. There are lots of efforts and initiatives globally to shift that, to make it more balkanized, and I think this framework is a step in the right direction away from that, and I think is quite helpful. As far as Congress, much of what we've heard thus far is twofold. One is, how can they help create a pathway for success for for the framework, which literally on the day that it was being advanced in, at the White House or released, we got calls from members of Congress saying, this is a positive step forward, we concurred, and how can we help? I think the second, which a year ago, after the president's statement and promise of getting this done, literally the week later, we were in California at RSA, which is a big cybersecurity conference, and there was a lot of anticipation and energy and concern around what is Congress going to do. My hope is that because of this framework, it creates a motivating force or an action-forcing event to get Congress to take on the elements of this that still require public policy. And so, and we intend to do everything we can to further encourage that.
Just a quick follow-up to you, Dean. When Congress staffers and representatives, senators phone you up and say, what can we do to help? What are you telling them?
You know, it's a great question. I tell them I need to talk to Danielle, who takes care of these things on our team. Much of what we've been focused on what they can do is, one, there's still the issue around making sure that we have real-time access to information and information sharing. And so heavy emphasis on that. The second part of it actually relates to something that we published on. DHS has an important role, and the Department of Homeland Security has an important role in this process going forward. And so what can we do to bolster what DHS and NIST is going to do to enable the success here? And I can get back to tangible steps that DHS should take.
We will come on to that. Just before we do, you also mentioned the roadmap. And Pat, this is, I think, a very welcome part of the document, but it's perhaps a piece that we less well understood because I think most people expect government to produce documents which then sit on shelves and gather dust. What you're, as you described, setting up a living document, an ongoing process, and the roadmap to a certain extent is the guidebook for that process. Could you just go in a little bit more detail on aspects like, you know, the workforce, the federal agency alignment, the international aspects, and how you see that working?
Well, we're pretty good at writing reports that consider constituents, too. So, but remember, this is not a government report. This was an industry document. And, you know, in your opening comment, you talked about the executive order laying out a year, which was an interesting time frame that was put in the executive order because depending on which perspective you had, that was either hopelessly too fast or completely unresponsive to the national need to protect critical infrastructure, right? So everyone was unhappy at some level. And so from a very pragmatic perspective, as we went through the process, you know, we built on existing foundations. It was about pulling best practices from everyone and then quickly identifying those gaps and putting those on the to-do list. So as the process continued to unfold, we had some focus. So we were trying to pull the learning we were getting out of going through the process the first time to make sure that we had both everything we could capture from best practice and the identified gaps. So part of that to-do list is pointing to this ongoing framework process, and it was things that were identified as part of the first go-through that are gap areas. They fall in two areas. One are things that, where the policy or the standards work needs to be advanced. Privacy, for example, is a good example there, where there was a lot of work to continue to identify those. And some of it has to do with the framework process itself, so governance, adoption, things of that type. So things like conformity assessment or government adoption, international, are issues that really go to how do you provide a framework structure that's conducive to the widest possible adoption. And I think that list is still itself open. I mean, you know, what we're going to, as we go forward, we'll be having new workshops. I think the first privacy workshop is actually in April. There'll be, you know, we'll be continuing sort of the full-throated engagement we had through the framework process. And at each one of these, you know, we'll be continuing to ask the group about gap areas. And that work list itself will be a living thing as we continue to revise and check things off.
And as people in this room and in the country at large pick out bits of the framework that they would like to comment on. Is there a mechanism in place to receive those comments?
Yeah. So, I mean, the framework website is still up. We still collect comments continuously, and we'll be feeding those, as we always do, sort of acting to compile and provide those to the group as we go forward. And then, you know, every new version, as they unfold, will, you know, be subject to the same kind of public comment. The one thing that's important to keep in mind with an ongoing process, though, is that, and this is really an important point, that if you're waiting for this to settle down before you do anything about it, you're going to miss the train, right? That's not what this is about. In fact, my view is that the framework will actually be driven by those who are the users and adopters of it, because most of the learning we're going to be doing from the framework is going to come from the hard-knock lessons about trying to put it into practice in your organization and finding out where it worked and where it didn't, and feeding that back into the process so it can be improved. So what we've been trying to be careful about is don't wait for perfection. We've been really asking where we most value are those companies who are rolling up their sleeves, who are going to give this a try, who are putting it to use, and are willing to then participate in the framework going forward to help refine it from that perspective. That turns out to be the most precious perspective.
That's particularly apt mm-hmm. in that there's a lot of discussion around incentives and the role they should play in getting people to adopt the framework. And we could easily spend all of our time focused on that and whether Congress is going to enable it or whether it can come with executive action and yet do nothing else. And I think the idea of moving forward while continuing to grow and improve is the apt approach.
I mean, yeah, I think the lesson, I think, of this document is that cybersecurity is not a state. It is a process. And this really helps to lay out a process to get there, but it's a continuous one.
I mean, the question of incentives is probably one worth spending a little bit of time on. The executive order actually did focus on incentives, and the administration put out some work on incentives, perhaps not as forcefully as it might have done, which reflects perhaps some internal discussions about how that ought to work. But I think what I'm hearing from you, Dean, is that you'd rather take the discussion away from incentives and focus on other aspects.
I wouldn't say ignore it. I would say, like Cam articulated it well, this is a process, and it's a process that's iterative where we'll continually improve. And so where we have improved mechanisms for incentivizing people, they'll get integrated into this like everything else. But in the intervening time, let's do the baseline work that we know is achievable today rather than waiting.
Yeah, let me make a quick comment on the incentives. The perspective I've taken through this whole discussion on the incentives was that, you know, the challenge to industry was it's in our national interest as a country to protect critical infrastructure. This is a clear national need. We think it's also in your business interest as organizations that run elements of critical infrastructure to protect these assets. And the best outcome of all is when it's totally aligned, when it's great business to be protective. And that's the premise under which a market-based, standards-driven, you know, internationally deployed framework makes the most sense. As we start to exercise that, we may find areas where there's a misalignment, where business interests aren't quite aligned, where there's, you know, unnatural. That's going to be the place where Congress needs to help us pay attention. And so in some sense, it's not so much any caution, I think, is not about internal skirmishes. It's about really a question of timing. That, again, I think the incentives debate is going to be really informed by those organizations that are putting this into practice. Because what you really want to zero in on is what are the barriers to using this.
Well, I mentioned that this has been an issue of great concerns in corporate executive suites over the last several years. That's a reflection that there are some powerful incentives to address this issue, some powerful business interests. Ask Target Corporation. Ask the the hundreds, thousands of companies that have had intellectual property stolen through cyber intrusions. As standards move forward, the SEC has guidance out there for assessing and disclosing cyber risk. Giving a set of benchmarks, helps to inform that process. So, there are plenty of good and important business reasons for companies to address this issue. Most companies know that. Now we have some tools to help that.
And one of the challenges, of course, for big companies, including Target, is, and it'll be interesting to see how the framework helps this process, is that some of those threats are getting more and more sophisticated, and that even if they take cybersecurity seriously, the cost of dealing with those high-end threats is challenging. How is the framework going to help deal with those advanced persistent threats that are hitting the headlines more and more frequently?
So I think in a couple of ways. One of them is that a lot of those advanced persistent threats are enabled by the same moving parts that the framework addresses. You know, it's failures in authentication, failures to understand your assets, failure to having the wrong behaviors within an organization that provide, the sort of latent vulnerabilities that these threats are designed to tackle. Now they get a little bit more sophisticated in how they do it. So that's one piece of it. I mean, there's a lot there that I think some of the statistics show that, some 80% of these are really, addressable by pretty basic application of well-known controls. But the other part is that the process is pointing to a continuous improvement process. Remember, the way that risk management framework works is to have the capacity to being able to identify what's happening on your system. In other words, one of the behaviors you're looking for organizations that use the framework is their self-awareness gets better and their responsiveness to an identified problem gets faster. And so those kind of behaviors are, specifically addressed. And then, as I said, to the extent there's actually gaps in the framework itself, let's see, the technology space opens up and you have brand new issues, let's say in the mobility space right now or in large data, the reason the process has to be continuous is that there has to be an ability to adapt in there as well.
So this is certainly one place where Congress could help. Legislation can help to facilitate the sharing of information about threats, sharing among companies, as well as sharing one direction with the government can take place. In the other direction is more complicated. So legislation would certainly help to make that easier to do.
It's a known market failure. All the participants in the market have identified it, and so the question is, what do we do about it? The one other thing I would add is much of the conversation thus far has focused on big businesses. We're small business representing big businesses, and we've actually talked to our outside vendor, looked at the framework, and identified ways that we can improve even in our organization using the framework. And so I think the great thing about it is that no matter your size of business or where you sit or which industry you fit within, it's sufficiently flexible and risk-based that you can find use out of it, and I think good use.
The other area where people have critiqued, if not criticized, the framework is those industries where the market doesn't dominate, so particularly regulated industries and those where there is a less obvious financial driver. How confident are you that the framework will be able to deliver on its national security objectives in those industries where, the bottom line might never get you to the level of cybersecurity that the required to deal with the grave threat that the president was talking about?
Well, I think, you know, time will tell ultimately how effective this is in those kinds of markets. But I should point out that those organizations operating under those market conditions were part of the full process from the beginning, and it was an explicit part of the discussion to make sure it was responsive to their needs and their issues as well. In fact, even up to and including the regulators themselves were part of the discussion. So we were actually, in an effort to make sure this alignment was real, that was a key part of the engagement that had to be there. So I hope that that's not the case, because you know the way I've articulated this to the companies themselves is that if you think of regulation as in addressing a market failure, then this is your chance to make sure the market has every opportunity to work, which is, I think, in everyone's best interest. And that has a number of intrinsic advantages, including the ability to operate at market scale, including overseas, the ability to be much more nimble and be able to change with flexing technology. And so I think everyone's bought into that theory of the case, and hopefully those alignment issues have been brought in. One part of the executive order that's raised a lot of questions, because it mentions the word regulation in the context of a voluntary program, is that there are regulated sectors here. And what we were trying to do is not end up in a situation where everybody worked together on this framework of practices, but then you were driven to do something different than that market solution by the regulation. So this is really an effort by the existing regulatory entities to have an opportunity to align against the framework. And that's the spirit in which they've been participating in that as well. And I think that would be a constructive thing.
I completely agree with that last point. Some of that, though, will be determined by what was outlined in the roadmap, how DHS, as well as all of the related agencies, align behind the framework. And that's one of the big question marks going forward.
And that's a good last area to focus on before we open it up to the floor. Implementation of the framework is going to be key. Having the industry involved in the framework puts a little bit of the onus on them. But within government, NIST will now be passing this process to a certain extent over to DHS and others. How, Pat, is that process going to work? And what are you going to do to make sure that the good momentum you've created continues once DHS take on the implementation process?
So I actually don't view the implementation responsibilities passing to DHS. So I think it's important to keep in mind there's three things happening here. One is the framework process continues, and NIST continues to act as the convener and will lead that. So nothing has changed on that front at all. What DHS is doing is has established a voluntary program that's there to support and promote adoption. And that includes acting as a clearinghouse for best practices and a whole set of other things that, within current authorities it can do to promote and support adoption. They've been working with us from the beginning. So we think we've done everything possible to make sure their efforts are aligned with what the framework is. But I want to end on sort of the final point. The most powerful force driving adoption are the companies themselves. And we see that from their discussions as they put this into use. This is not just about what you do internally. This is about your relationship with your vendors, your suppliers, your supply chains, other companies that you work with in your sector. This is the way the sector community organizes to consider how this is going to look for them. And those are actually more powerful than almost anything we've been discussing that we can do from helping on the government side. So I think, sometimes people have construed a voluntary program as toothless, and I just don't subscribe to that. I think, they're very powerful. In fact, every product safety standard in the United States is basically self-regulated by industry through standards. And, these can be very muscular approaches, and I think that's really going to be where a lot of the lift comes from in driving adoption.
Cam?
I'm ready to go to questions.
Just before we do, Dean, you mentioned you had some thoughts on DHS's role in promoting the framework.
I think some of it is already contemplated, and so I know that there are a number of workshops that have been scheduled already, and I think Pat mentioned one of them. So part of it is education, doing what we're doing here today, but on a much larger scale and a more sustained scale. Two is making sure we're measuring the right things, so developing clear metrics for evaluating the success of this effort. Third is, and we've alluded to it earlier, which is the focus on incentives. I think they're important, but we shouldn't make them the only thing. And then the collaborative process, the final part, which is the collaborative process that NIST has adopted, is one that's worked exceptionally well, and it's critical that we keep that as a part of the work going forward. It's truly the way to ensure that it becomes broadly integrated in how businesses operate, and so I hope it will not be forgotten.
I'd like to come back to what success looks like at the end, but since we have so many people here, I'd like to open it up for questions. We have some microphones going around. The usual Brookings rules apply. Keep your question short, end it with a question mark, and please give your affiliation when you ask it. So down here at the front, please.
Good afternoon. Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Deanne Divis. I'm with Inside GNSS. I wanted to ask a question about a critical element as identified by the Department of Homeland Security across all 16 of the critical infrastructure sectors, and that's position, navigation, and timing information, GPS, which is essential for a lot of networks, for example. And DHS appears to be looking at the 16 sectors to implement protections with regard to that data, to the GPS data that they require. And I'd like to hear from the panel what you see coming up with through the roadmap, coming up down the roads with regards to standards or other actions to integrate the PNT, the position, navigation, and timing data, and to make sure that you know organizations have what they need when they need it.
So, you know, anyone reading the 39 pages of the framework would not see PNT showing up as a where, and that's going to be one of those examples of an issue that's embedded in the standards sets that are in the core, because it points to a particular class of, you know, time-critical, position-critical data, and I think what the framework attendees were terming a dependency and making sure that that's been addressed. Without getting into, you know, the specific threat or vulnerability that DHS is worried about, my guess is since NIST has a lot to do with the time basis for that, we're probably working on a technical level with them already. But, you know, the framework becomes a vehicle for, and this is why the federal agency participation was so important, for threat informing the process. If there really is a new class of vulnerability that's essential to critical infrastructure, particularly cross-sector like that, we're counting on DHS as a participant in that process to flag that and make sure that we take that back to industry as part of this process and make sure that the framework process, you know, doesn't have that as a gap area, right? That's something that's explicitly addressed.
Actually, if I can add one thing, which is maybe lost in this, is that as a part of the executive order, all of the agencies, the federal agencies, are supposed to cascade the framework and I think are to come back with their ideas around it as well within a defined time period. And so I think that work is incredibly important as well. So it's not isolated to DHS or NIST, but is cascaded broadly within all the relevant agencies.
We get to eat our own cooking.
So at the back, uniform. Sorry, not back, further back. You're there. You with the microphone, sorry.
Hi, Brian Moore with the Coast Guard, Contingency Preparedness and Consequence Management. When you use the safety model as an example, it triggered something in my mind. Do you see in the future a like a credit rating agency or an ISO type of third party to provide an audit function on companies, how well they've implemented the framework, and then provide a grade or something of that sort, so that, like you said, so the suppliers can know, okay, I'm only going to work with grade A suppliers, and if you don't meet that mark, then you can't do business with me, something like that.
So the way I would answer your question is to pick up on the last point you just raised. What we call these are conformity assessment. In other words, you've developed a set of practices, and it may very well be critical to a given organization to, from a business-to-business perspective, to know that the people they're working with conform to some level within those standards. So this is a voluntary program, so the government's not going to be setting up a grade. But, in fact, something we have posed to the framework process is you may very well find that for this to work, you need that kind of conformity assessment. And there's a lot of different types, going all the way from self-attestation all the way to third-party testing and accreditation. And the trick is there's not a right or wrong one. The question is, which is the right approach given the market conditions you're facing? And so that's very much on the to-do list, actually, that was in the framework plan.
And to take the question a little bit widely, one of the elephants in the room of cybersecurity for many years has been this question of cyber insurance. And there has been some suggestions that the framework might offer an opportunity to the insurance industry, giving it a set of metrics to use. What sense do you have from your discussions about whether that's likely, possible, realistic?
Well, I'm not sure my crystal ball is any better than anyone else's, but I will tell you there was enormous interest and participation by the insurance sector in this for that reason. Look, as soon as you put something into a risk management framework, the idea of, you know, all those assets we have for doing risk management come to play, including, insurance markets. And, my sense is they have found the process very useful, and I think there's some very active discussions. In fact, we've had a number of breakout sessions in almost every workshop on this particular issue specifically.
In addition to hearing from members of Congress and their staff about this, the other folks we heard a lot from are companies who intend or are examining whether to get in that space, insurance companies, but also law firms who are evaluating what this all means. And so I think Pat is absolutely right.
Yeah, I think this, the sort of audit process that you've mentioned and that Pat's outlined is an example of how standards work in the marketplace. I don't have a better crystal ball than Pat to say whether that definitely will occur here, but certainly the part of the idea is in creating the tools, the benchmarks, is to inform that process. So a number of the organizations that are involved in some of the underlying standards, ISO is one of them. There are others that perform audit functions. Some 40% of the corporate sector now has insurance against data breaches. And that is triggering exactly the sort of engagement by insurance companies to take a close look at people's practices. This is a way to benchmark that look. In the securities area, I mentioned earlier, SEC guidance. To this point, most companies have been able to sort of sweep it aside by saying that their risk is not material. I'm not sure after the Target or Neiman Marcus experience that it's so easy to do that. And again, for boards, for shareholders, for auditors, there's now a roadmap that people can look to assess those issues.
So, Cam, do you see people making investments based on where people sit within in the framework?
I think that companies will have to take a more critical look at the disclosures that they make, and I think that in turn can influence investors.
And the point you made earlier, Cam, about CEOs spending real time with their boards, shareholders, around these issues, I think is indicative of how important this is and the creation of a real marketplace to mitigate those risks.
Next question. At the back on the aisle. Sorry, not at the back. In the middle on the aisle.
Thank you. Dana Goward with the R&T Foundation. I'd like to follow up on the question about PNT vulnerability. That's become a quite the subject of late. GAO report in November. In fact, the UK and Russia and China have terrestrial systems to back up their PNT to ensure they're not dependent upon the faint signal from space. So did I understand, Peter, to say that this has not been flagged as a problem by DHS or anyone in terms of cybersecurity and impacting the cybersecurity of the nation?
No, I wouldn't characterize it that way. What I meant to say was that the extent to which PNT standards are found or lack of redundancy or whatever the specific issue is would be reflected in those things that are referenced in the framework core. What I am not aware of is whether DHS raised PNT as a specific issue as we were putting together the top-level framework structure. That's not to say they didn't raise it as one of the constituent standards. In other words, you have a little bit of an onion here in terms of you have the overall framework process and then you have the constituent standards underneath. I would expect, given the nature of PNT, that this would be one of the constituent standards discussions, not in the overall framework.
So we should burrow down into it, see if you can find it.
But the NIST team is sitting in front, so if you want a direct follow-up afterwards, right there.
This side on the aisle, please.
Hi there, Todd Curran. I'm with the Canadian Embassy. Looking globally, can you talk a little bit about the reception that you've had both from allies and foreign companies?
So I think you might want to get a couple of perspectives here. The overall reaction we've gotten from the very beginning was a combination of intense interest, wanting to wait and see what it looked like when it was done. And most promising of all, I think, an understanding that this can be used as a foundation for a variety of approaches around the world, even including those areas that we're considering more national response, even including a regulatory response. Because one of the things we point out is that, again, if you want to not, this is a global infrastructure. And it's really important that information and data companies be able to operate on that scale. That's what makes this technology so powerful. Then aligning to, just like we've asked our own internal regulators in the critical infrastructure space to align to this, is something that can be done on the international scale. And we've had a lot of positive reaction to that. The most interesting one was coming from Europe, and it had to do with the fact that in the same week that the president released the executive order, the European Commission was proposing some draft approaches that were going to be used for cybersecurity. And from the very beginning, they've been quite interested and looking at this as a basis for moving forward.
Yeah, 30% of the companies we represent are international, non-U.S.-based entities, and the reaction has been favorable as well. They operate in a world that's global, integrated, interconnected. They offer services, products, systems that they want to work on a global basis, and so appreciate and welcome the framework. They're also competing in a marketplace where increasingly their efforts to use cybersecurity or national security as a market access barrier, so whether it's the multi-level protection scheme in China or some of the problems we had around preferential market access in India. And so having this framework that's built on global standards that are consensus-based and developed through multi-stakeholder processes is helpful to those international companies as well.
Pat, this is something that NIST does across its business, dealing with international standards. What would be the process to internationalize the framework or at least give it more, encourage its use internationally?
So what we did in this case was actually something that was modeled after the approach we took with smart grid standard setting a few years back, which was we started with the premise that the framework process was immediately international. We invited international participation. I was meeting with delegations from around the world as this actually started. And we made a deliberate effort to look at international standards as one of the building blocks of the framework and we're asked companies to bring those forward. So in some sense, we've been international from the beginning. I think the more, and by the way, I expect the international flavor of the framework process to actually grow as we go forward. That was actually identified in the roadmap, as we expect this to happen. What'll be interesting is maybe more on the adoption side. In other words, the extent to which conformity assessment, certification or product identity, the extent to which those can be put into a global infrastructure or a global context will be very interesting. And then because you're dealing with critical national infrastructure, how do countries respond to that from their own national policy perspective to align and do something that makes sense there? So I think that's going to be really the two issues there, is this matching between the national and this global market. And how does the industry want to put in the muscle and the compliance piece itself? It works there. Will be quite interesting.
Who else? Down the second row, please.
Hi, Rick Weber at Insight Cybersecurity. Dr. Gallagher, could you speak a little bit more about the next phase in terms of when the framework or how the framework will be revised? So where and when will we know that it's going to be revised?
So we haven't announced a revision schedule yet for the framework. In fact, what we've done is deliberately created a bit of a pause in our engagement in setting up the kind of workshop schedule that would point to any kind of revision, for the very reason I didn't want to get in the way of the adoption piece. We really want companies using this, and we have stated from the beginning we would like the follow-up discussions in the framework process to be informed by those organizations that are using the framework. But we have set up a tentative schedule of workshops that are on the framework website. I think the first one is probably the privacy one in April, and then I think there's another one in the summer, July. Again, there's really no surprise in what the agenda is, because the roadmap was laid out in that process. I actually am not expecting major revisions to the framework itself. I think the real impetus is going to be going after these gap areas and identifying those places where we felt that, there was some real work to be done. And also, I think, maturing what we call the governance discussions. In other words, we should now start seriously taking on, if this framework is going to be an ongoing process and normalcy is success, not that I'm looking for NIST getting out of the business, but how do we set up a governance scheme where all of these different companies can work together to turn this into an ongoing routine process? And again, we've had experience doing that both in the cloud sector and smart grid and other areas. And I think we would like to continue those discussions as well.
What does your experience in the smart grid sector and cloud sector tell you that will end up looking like?
Well, I mean, probably the most mature of those right now is the discussions in the smart grid, just because it's a little bit older than the cloud side. And the cloud effort was really focused on the government adoption side with FedRAMP. But at smart grid, a smart grid interoperability panel, which is an actual 501c3 organization, was put together because the stakeholder group felt that there wasn't an existing organization that could sort of help facilitate that process, so they established one of their own. NIST has provided funding for the operation of that organization. We remain sort of working with them routinely today, where you now have sort of a living cycle of, okay, here are the technical issues that are changing, here's the new ones, here's the top priorities to fix. The Smart Grid Interoperability Panel sort of does the triage, and in many cases now works with all of the different standards organizations that are supporting that, trying to say, hey, look, this is a key area to improve, and then making sure that the adoption side of that is worked at, because, again, that was interfacing with a regulated industry as well, and so making sure that all of that was put into shape. I think it might look different. It probably will look different because this is a different sector. And so we're not going in with this is what the answer looks like. But our view is, and this may take a while to put together, but we think it's worth continuing the discussions about, how do we do this if this is not a one-time through process, but this is something we do year in and year out.
Thank you for this discussion. My name's Lynn Garland, unaffiliated. You've spoken a bit about how the federal government agencies are going to comment on this and react, and how industry has incentive. And I was wondering, how are you going to get the state governments to adopt this and get involved? Because a lot of things are at state level that are very important.
So that's a great question, and I suspect a number of us want to jump
in. But we'll
in.
Let you answer, Pat.
So we've had strong interest from the states. In fact, a number of state CIOs were at the event rolling out the framework. I was talking to them about their framework process, and they actually end up touching this problem at a number of different levels. Many of these critical infrastructure entities are actually interacting heavily with the states. In some cases, they're regulated or involved with states themselves anyway. And so, again, this harmonization issue comes right out for them, that this is an important building block because it is something that they can use as a framework for dealing with these organizations. Think of water utilities and others that are happening at this level. The other place that this is very helpful to them is that the extent to which we see widespread adoption of the framework means that the technology providers that are providing technology and software and security solutions to support these companies are now creating a market of some scale that can help drive down cost and can improve performance. And that advantages all the states who maybe in and of themselves wouldn't have the market scale to drive this outcome. And so I think, you know, again, we've encouraged state participation from the very beginning. They have been involved in the framework process from the very beginning, and I think you're going to continue to see their involvement ramp up. Yeah.
Well, the only thing is, one of the reasons we've been pushing for legislation at the federal level is a fear that you would end up with a mishmash of state legislation that don't allow for these sorts of efficient, effective markets. I think the framework is helpful because to the extent that it creates a baseline that is collaborative and based on these sorts of standards, I think it's quite helpful in avoiding that.
But how do you see the framework being used at the federal government level? I mean, there are some clear examples of the requirement for improved cybersecurity within the federal government, and how do you see this being rolled out across that sector of government?
So the we actually, at the rollout for the framework, talked a little bit about this in terms of government use. You know, the most straightforward thing that every adopting company is doing right now is to use the framework to develop profiles of your current practice. That's what's laid out in the framework. And one of the first things we'll be doing is at the agency level using this to, very much like you did with your organization, trying to develop profiles where both where are we at today, where would we like to go. That's part of that adoption support system that's built into the framework. I think this is actually going to be really interesting because the maturity model aspect of the implementation tiers that are in the framework could be extremely helpful to the federal government because they move the debate past the application of controls and the notion that the only thing you can assess and measure is how many of the controls you put in place. You know, under the framework, that's a tier one implementation level. And what this starts to point to is that, you know, you can move beyond that into a real risk management framework at a higher maturity level that has, you know, bigger advantages. And so I think it opens up the palette of really addressing this as a risk management exercise within the government. And finally, the last one is there's been a tendency to address cybersecurity performance issues in the government by just making the CIOs more and more muscular. And what the framework actually points to is a different answer, which is integrating it with the program lines, right? This is going to the boardrooms and to the CEOs. And I think it points to a very interesting outcome, which is it really starts with the cabinet-level secretaries and real accountability there and looking at this from an integrated perspective. So we've just started that, but I think that's going to be really quite interesting.
Cam, you've been a cabinet-level secretary for a short time.
I was privileged to have a wonderful acting deputy secretary, Dr. Patrick Gallagher. One of the things that he has done in that capacity is to really take in hand the cybersecurity management at the Department of Commerce. I think you called it eating our own cooking, and to do that in terms of making management at the highest levels of the department accountable for cybersecurity, and not simply something that our CIOs deal with.
And would you see those profiles being published, made publicly available?
I don't, as a FOIA lawyer, there's no obvious exemption. There may be security issues and aspects of them.
But let me go back to the point that the framework is not about the controls, right? In any organization, you're going to have a dynamic set of controls. Our CIOs are drowning in piles of controls that they're to be looking at, and by the way, other mandates outside of the security space. What's unique about the framework from the government perspective is the management approach to really integrate it into how you run a department and to make those decisions, not just technology decisions, but skill set and hiring and cost allocation and all the other things that are just as much a part of cybersecurity as controls. And so, in some ways, this is a very fresh perspective on the government approach, and I think that management approach could be very public. And that's actually probably more important. That's where the real accountability lies.
So we have two questions. If we could take them both, and then we'll I have two questions to finish. So we'll take both questions, and then we'll answer them.
Yes, I'm Adrian Indira, Security Studies Fellow at Georgetown University. I just wanted to come back on your comment, Mr. Gallagher, about the controls. If I understand correctly, the controls are a first step, tier one out of four. Does that mean that the controls have been adopted, at least in the government today?
So let me be a little bit careful about what the implementation tiers point to. So there's controls at every level. I mean, controls are a important aspect of how you control a particular risk. So I'm not saying there's only controls at tier one and then you can get away from the controls. What the implementation tiers point to is your, in some ways, your maturity in managing this risk. And so I think of tier one as sort of being a rule-following culture. In other words, you create a to-do list and success is I got through the list and I'm doing all this, I can do it reliably and repeatably. That's quite different than an adaptive or proactive type culture where in addition to having the rules and controls, you're actually actively identifying new changes and new threats and preemptively. So it's going from a set of static controls to almost an immune system. So controls are everywhere, but you asked an interesting question. Where will the federal government end up as we start doing profiles? I don't know, but I think because my suspicion is that because we've been sort of mesmerized by control and control application audit against control, we will probably not, shouldn't be too surprised to find ourselves near an implementation level that's really focused on that, which would be around one. But we'll see, and I think that'll be quite interesting as we to do that.
Final question.
Gaurang Shah from Booz Allen Hamilton. One of the things panel talked about was the alignment of the business interest with the national interest. So let me give you a scenario and just see, how would that really change in the corporate, world. We all talked about, again, Target and Neiman Marcus. And I recently read this study where, the U.S. credit cards are like eon behind like the European credit card. We still use the magnetic, strip and everything. And I think like Visa and MasterCard and American Express, they did the study and they say right now, something like, the Target Neiman Marcus scenario, we are losing, say, $7 billion a year. But if we have to replace all of the credit cards, it's going to cost us more like $11 billion, right? So normally, cybersecurity, they don't really do the typical financial ROI, but in this case, they are doing that. So how do we make sure that some of those, you know, financial interest, you know, does not overtake, you know, what you would call the national, you know, interest?
Well, I think, you know, underneath your question is, I think, one of the profound issues that Congress will face. If these are not aligned, I think that's, you know, because ultimately we're talking about something that, if it fails under a cyber attack, has grave harm to the country. And so that's just going to get fixed somehow. But I think, backing up a little bit, I'm not sure I would buy that the financial risk assessment that they were looking at was correct. In the following sense, you know, you're correct that one of the issues that the United States has seen in this sector is we were early adopters in card technology. We have a very expensive deployed technology base. And it's being compared about against much younger technology bases for card readers and so forth in other places. And with that legacy comes some vulnerability. And the question really will be, yes, you know, that's why the risk management approach is so important. You know, to what extent does the refresh rate of the technology help us mitigate and control these risks? And that's a question that I assume a good framework-following organization would be going after. But this is not just the direct financial loss of those customers that lost their information. And that's certainly not what I'm hearing from the CEOs. This is a profound reputational loss. This is potentially going right at their market share. And I think the what I'm hearing from CEOs is a very acute sensitivity that this is a big deal, and this is why it's rising to the very top of the boardrooms as a discussion. So I'd be surprised if they were reaching that kind of simple apples to oranges comparison, because that doesn't track with what I'm hearing from CEOs today.
Yeah, I think Pat is right that you know, cost benefit analysis is in today's environment wrong. I think it reflects what has been historically the challenge of dealing with cybersecurity, that, you know, the CIOs, the compliance officers were worrying about it, but it was a cost issue, and so it was difficult to get attention. I think because of the reputational concerns, because of the impact, you know, if you are a company that has a significant failure, I think that is changing. That's reflected in you know, the level of concern that Pat talked about it. And I think we're seeing that reflected in some of the demand, you know, from the corporate sector to change, for example, card technology, despite the economics that you talked about.
Yeah, I work in a highly disruptive sector where companies don't exist, largely based on new innovation. And key to the success of those companies are trust and integrity. And so to the extent that we don't take cybersecurity seriously, we're undermining that trust and integrity. And that's a principal reason why it is one of the issues that I hear perhaps most often from our most senior executives at the companies that I represent. It is truly one of their top priorities. And so it is right in pure analytical or quantitative sense, it may not show up, but the brand and identity damage is so significant that it's frontal to their consciousness on all of these issues.
Pat, I'm going to take the moderator's prerogative to ask one penultimate question before we end up looking at what success looks like in this. And that's just to tickle the question of privacy. That this was explicit when the president issued the executive order that everything you produced needed to respect privacy. And throughout the process, there was clearly concern from what you might call the privacy lobby to ensure that that was the case. And you have adapted what you've produced, in part, I suspect, in response to some of that. Can you just tell the story of that so that we have a better understanding of how you've the responses that you've had and how you have adapted the framework to reply to some of those concerns?
Well, I think the short version of that story is the one you laid out, that privacy was an explicit requirement for us to consider as we developed the framework from the very beginning. It was actually part of every discussion and every workshop we had, including the kickoff workshop. I remember having a discussion about the incorporation of privacy at that point. What seemed to happen, and, you know, we could, I guess, go back and have a discussion about what the psychology was, but it tended to be an issue where, first of all, the maturity on some of, you know, how do you implement, you know, what's the building blocks that you build implementation of good privacy protection was less mature than what was true in a lot of the cybersecurity areas. Mm-hmm. And I think partly based on that, it was relegated, even though we brought it up at every workshop, it was one that we kept pinging, saying this is one we need to work on. And one of the consequences of that is that up in about midway through the process, the privacy principles were basically in a standalone section as an appendix. And I think maybe that's what caught everyone's attention. When that construct was finally there, I think then the stakeholder group that was working on the framework, all 3,000 of them, jumped in. And it was actually an interesting perspective on how the framework worked. A whole group of industries stood up and said, this doesn't really make sense to have this be a bolt-on attachment. You know, this is based on the same kind of data protection principles that are integrated, and they made a counterproposal to integrate those into the main framework. So now it's actually integrated and not bolted on, and that's where we stand today.
Cam, as Commerce's former top
well,
player.
I think where it ended up is the right place. Security is an essential ingredient of privacy. It is part of the privacy principles. It's part of the White House Consumer Privacy Bill of Rights. So, it's really not a standalone issue. There are privacy implications of some of the cybersecurity practices, particularly when you get into sharing information with third parties or, in particular, the government. So it's important to incorporate into the framework privacy practices, as has been done. But it really is part and parcel of security.
Seen some of your member companies be extremely vocal on this.
Yes, so we were one of the stakeholders who were concerned with the bolted-on approach, and so like Cam, we think it ended up in the right place. I do note that it's one of the 9, I think, work streams, and so we intend to continue to stay engaged and work to ensure that it's progressed forward.
Which brings me to my last question, which is, you know, as we do progress forward, what do we think success is going to look like? And an important part of the framework, I hope I'm correct in thinking, is to assess where there may be a requirement for legislation or others to engage. So question for each of the panelists is, you know, how will we know whether other action is required? But more importantly, you know, what does success look like, and how can we be confident that this is delivering what we think it should deliver? And if we could come down this way, it'll give Pat a last word.
Thank you very much. I think a big part of it is adoption. So the extent to which most businesses are looking at the framework and integrating it into their operations, much in the way we talked about CEOs making it a part of their boardroom discussion. The second part of it is if it, in fact, doesn't become a stale document that sits on shelves, but does become a living, breathing, iterative process, as opposed to an endpoint, whereby we're still working on it 10 years from now. And then gaps with Congress, I think we've spoken to those, and there are quite a number. The most pressing one that I think can be dealt with on its own is around information sharing.
How much confidence do you have that that's going to have success?
A high degree of confidence, The question is when. So my confidence, I'm sitting in a discussion with Congressman Rogers and Ruppersberger on Monday, and so I hate to say anything that's going to lead them to be upset with me, but just given the legislative calendar, I think it's highly unlikely that anything meaningful will occur in this Congress, but I do think there is a sincere interest in finding a solution.
So I guess to put a metric on it, my answer would be a version 2.0 or some 1 point, some significant number, because I think that would be a reflection, as Dean said, that there is active engagement, active adoption, and that that experience has leading to the iterative process, and an indication that the model is working.
So I always like it when the NIST guy gets asked the measurement question. How do you measure success? We like that. So, for me, the acid test of all this is our nation's critical infrastructure better protected. It's also the hardest thing to measure, right? That's going to be very challenging. So I think of the success stories having sort of two elements. One is the near term, and I think that's the adoption. And the way I've characterized it is this inevitable? You know, this is what everyone's doing, and we're struggling with those kind of nuts and bolts issues. They may be tough, but they're the kind of things that would only come up with organizations that are really trying to use this. That's a big success, because that means this is actually being put into practice, and you have a framework to improve and drive. And then I think there's an intermediate set of metrics that I think are potentially very powerful, and it kind of goes to the safety comparison. So while the final outcome may be something that we only learn retrospectively looking back, I hope that we start seeing some very meaningful improvements in what I would call security behavior. And that can be the capacity within organizations to be able to identify and manage risks. That can be the capacity of staff. It could be skill level. It could also be behaviors like self-awareness. The fact that we know what's happening on our systems more, our speed to respond improves. I think there's a set of security behaviors that are quite measurable that would point to a healthier organization in managing these risks. And I think, my hope is that, we'll be working with industry. That's kind of a NIST thing to do, to try to identify some meaningful measurements along those lines.
Well, thank you. We look forward to returning for Cybersecurity Framework 2.0, 3.0, perhaps having the Chancellor of the University of Pittsburgh come back and comment on it. I would like to thank all of you for joining us here today, and invite you to join me thanking Dean Garfield, Cam Carey, and Pat Gallagher for a fantastic panel.